Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David A. Bossert, award-winning artist, filmmaker, and animation artist with over 35 years' experience in the animation industry. And we're talking about his book, The House of the Future, Walt Disney, MIT, and Monsanto's Vision of Tomorrow. David, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
This is a fascinating story, but I have to mention for the audience, this is a really beautiful book, beautifully laid out. And first of all, you're dealing with this kind of futurism, which I think is really beautiful. How did you gather all the photos, the architectural plans, and so on? Was it difficult?
Well, you know, with any of my book projects, I always set out to try and find material people haven't seen before. And so there's a lot of detective work involved, and I did a deep dive into a lot of different archives in order to find some of the material that's in the book.
Some of the material, obviously, I've never seen before. The architectural drawings and stuff like that, I found those endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, and by the way, I have to give a shout out to the MIT Museum in Boston, Massachusetts,
nice.
Because they were hugely helpful.
Now, this is about the House of the Future. It was part of Disneyland, specifically part of Tomorrowland, from 1957 to 1967, which is only a decade, but it seems to have tapped into something very basic in American culture. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this came about not as a Disneyland attraction initially, but as a research project between the Monsanto's Plastics Division and MIT in Massachusetts. And this was really trying to address an issue of using plastics in home construction, because at the time you had a lot of new young families after World War II that were moving out of the cities and into the suburbs.
Right.
And there was a lot of home construction going on, and there was some shortages of materials. And Monsanto looked at it as an opportunity to use this new, you know, miracle material, plastics, to create structural pieces for homes and also try and revolutionize home design.
It's fascinating because we were talking off mic about this. This post-World War II period was a time of real optimism and people really looking favorably towards a future, and something we don't really have right now. And it's amazing going through this book because you really, if you lived through that era, this book really brought that up to me viscerally about, wow, what a forward-thinking culture it was at that point in time. Now, this idea of using plastics as a building material was sort of revolutionary.
Absolutely. And you got to remember, plastics was in its infancy in the early 1950s. And so they were looking at this as a material that would really revolutionize people's lives. And in a sense, it has. But I think there was unintended consequences of the use of plastics that we're starting to see in the environment today.
Absolutely. And so that's another weird aspect of the book, is to read all this stuff and realize people have very negative ideas about the building materials right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have to, you know, again, I think we're going through this with artificial intelligence, AI.
Yeah.
We don't know what the unintended consequences are. And maybe 50 or 60 years from now, people are going to look back and go, my gosh, you know, they thought AI was going to be the greatest thing in the world. And look what it's done. Now we have to fix this.
The design of this house is just brilliant. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to see if you can do it. Can you orally describe the sort of basic look of this house?
Yes. If you look down on top of this house, it looks like a plus sign or, a Red Cross symbol. The house itself sat on a 16 by 16 foot concrete core. And so you had these wings hanging off of that core. So what was really interesting about this house was that it had such a small footprint, which meant that it could be used for lots of different terrain that might not have been practical for building.
The other thing is the whole landscaping around the house was beautiful, too.
Absolutely. That's really John Hanch, who was one of the Imagineers at Walt Disney Imagineering. And he really wanted to put in sort of these Japanese gardens around the house as a way of softening this structure a little bit.
Well, also, you needed something because it's right in back of Sleeping Beauty's castle. Or right, so there's several photographs where you see this incredible futuristic house, and then behind it is this Sleeping Beauty's castle. You sort of needed a little extra something on the outside to sort of break that sort of juxtaposition.
Absolutely, and if you go to Disneyland, they're masterful at creating these small environments next to one another that are completely different.
Yeah.
And that's how you got Adventureland with the jungles and Frontierland.
Wow.
And then Fantasyland. It was all done through architecture and landscaping.
Now, Monsanto, I think at this time, their plastics division was based right here in Massachusetts in Springfield.
Yes, it was. In fact, the testing that they did, each wing is made up of four what they called bents, which were made out of fiberglass. And the first two bents, the top and bottom bent, were manufactured on Long Island at a boat company that made fiberglass boats. And those were brought up to Massachusetts, where they hung them on a core and did all their stress testing. So that was all done in Massachusetts at the Monsanto facility.
Well, talk to me about the MIT connection. So they were the designers?
Correct. So you had Marvin Goody and Richard Hamilton, the two architects that were at MIT at the time as teachers. And what Monsanto did was it funded a research project with MIT's architectural department and civil engineering department to come up with a new home design that was revolutionary. And the mandate was to make it out of as much plastic as was practical. And that's what they set out to do.
Now, let's bring in Disney. Now, this is the early years of Disneyland. And what was Walt Disney's vision for Disneyland? Let's get really basic. What did he envision Disneyland to be?
Well, you know, Walt envisioned Disneyland to be this really wonderful amusement park that was nothing like the amusement parks of the day. You know, he had consultants telling him he had to put a midway in with games to really, you know, make a lot of money and rip off people. And that's the thing Walt did want to do. Instead of a midway, he put in Main Street USA. He wanted people to be able to come into a park that was clean and safe and family-friendly. And most of the parks at the time were these rickety carnival-type amusement parks that, you know, weren't as safe, were dirty to some degree, and were there just to try and rip people off of their money. And he wanted to do something different, and that was the birth of the theme park. And as far as him trying to open that, he could not have done it without corporate sponsors. And that's where Monsanto comes in. You know, Walt knew the CEO of Monsanto at the time, and Monsanto came in as an early sponsor and opened what was called the Hall of Chemistry in Tomorrowland. And that was one of the first exhibits in Tomorrowland that you saw when you came into the park in 1955, when the park opened. And so it was only natural that Walt would find out about this research project Monsanto was doing with MIT. And I have a photo in the book of Walt with Marvin Goody, one of the architects, at a plastics convention in 1954, where he's looking at a model of the house. And so it just seemed like a natural fit. Walt needed stuff for Tomorrowland. That was one of the sparsest lands when the park opened. and they had the space to put the house in there. And Monsanto wanted the public to see it, and what better place to do it than at Disneyland? I mean, it had over 20 million visitors in 10 years, just that one attraction, the house.
That's amazing. And they walked through the house. There was a whole—
That's correct.
There's a whole— and you have the map in the book. There's a whole way that you walked through, essentially seeing every single one of the rooms in the house. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this just fit into a whole sort of vision. And you bring up the word people would use today would be retro future. But this house looks like something the Jetsons would live in. It really reminds me of the New York World's Fair at that time and the whole thing. This really beautiful vision of these gently curved objects, whether it was a table, whether it was a chair, or whether it was the rooms themselves. There was a certain look to the place that was just fascinating, and I think it's really beautiful.
You know, I agree with you, and, you know, you bring up a good point about the furnishings in the house. It had a look. Well, a lot of those pieces of furniture were designed by legendary furniture designers of the day, and some of those pieces are actually still available. The coconut lounge chair that's in the living room is actually still available through Herman Miller. You can buy that chair today, and that's, you know, we're talking more than 65 years later.
You cover all the bases in this book. You talk about, you know, redesigning the house and how it, one of the earliest of the 20th century was Buckminster Fuller, who did the Dymaxium house. Talk about that.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, of course, Buckminster Fuller was a futurist and a forward thinker. And so, you know, he had designed the Dymaxium house. And I'm sure that the architects that designed the house of the future for Disneyland, for Monsanto, I'm sure that they were aware of the Dymaxium house. They had probably had seen it and maybe even studied it because that was built in the late 1930s. So, again, I think that, you know, all of these types of things, people are building off the shoulders of giants, as they say.
And it's funny when you compare the photographs in your book of the Dymaxium house to the house of the future. I don't want to say this, but the Dymaxium house looks a little clunky. It looks like it looks like a big Hershey's Kiss.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks exactly like a big Hershey's Kiss made out of copper.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's kind of an interesting design, and there were certainly interesting things within it. But I prefer the Monsanto house.
Yeah, no kidding.
Future, from a design standpoint. And in fact, I even say at the end of the book, I think the Walt Disney Company should actually make a couple of those and put them on the property at the Contemporary Resort down in Walt Disney World and let guests stay in those.
Oh, absolutely. Without question. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David A. Bossert, award-winning artist and filmmaker with over 35 years experience in the animation industry. And we're talking about his latest book, The House of the Future, Walt Disney, MIT, and Monsanto's Vision of Tomorrow. Now let's talk about the different— you have a tour map, and so you review each room as you go, as if you would go through the tour, which I think is cool. But I'll tell you, the photographs, where did you find all those photographs? I mean, every aspect of all the rooms is represented in your book.
Yeah, so, you know, when I set out to write this book, Mark, I have to tell you, I had never seen the House of the Future.
Right, you were born too late.
Yeah, I actually could have seen it if I lived in Southern California, but I lived and grew up on Long Island in New York. And so I had actually been to Walt Disney World before I ever went to Disneyland. So by the time I visited Disneyland in 1980 for the first time,
it was gone.
The house was gone by 13 years. So what I set out to do with the book was I wanted to take a tour of the House of the Future in as an immersive way as I possibly could. And so at one point, after I talked the backstory of how the house came to be, I have a tour map, and it's really a representation of what the original tour map would have been. And each chapter after that is exactly what you would have seen had you walked through the house. So I put it in the same order. And I tried to put in each chapter, which represents each room of the house, exactly what you would have seen, not only in 1957 when it first opened, but the subsequent remodel.
Right, right. I'm fascinated not only, first of all, by the overall designs of each room, but there's all these weird little, whether it's stuff that's on the wall or sort of little knickknacks or whatever, all of it seems to represent the future. I mean, it's just amazing. The whole look, the color scheme, the lighting. Let's talk about the lighting in these rooms. There's really fascinating sort of gentle lighting throughout these spaces.
Yeah, they used a lot of diffused lighting.
And at that time, nobody saw a lot of that.
No, they hadn't. And there was something interesting in the bathrooms. They had phosphorescent panels.
Yeah.
So when the lights were out, these panels had this like soft green glow to them, which was like a nightlight.
Wow. Let's talk about the Adams for Living kitchen. First of all, I love the name of that.
I know.
Okay. So Kelvinator, which is one of the great refrigerator companies, it's a division of American Motors Corporation. What is this thing about irradiation of food that they talk about?
Yeah, so, you know, they had, and by the way, Kelvinator at the time was the appliance brand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, they had like 90% of the refrigeration market, and they have disappeared. If you talk to somebody today and ask them about Kelvinator, they'd look at you cross-eyed. And but in the 1950s, they were the kitchen appliance company. And so they had a refrigeration system in the House of the Future that was three separate compartments that would drop down out of the cabinets by push button. And so you had regular refrigeration, you had a cold storage or freezer type of refrigeration, and then you had an area that was for irradiated food.
What did that mean?
And again, this was something that was cutting edge at the time.
But what does it mean?
Well, it meant that they were using essentially radiation, gamma radiation, to make food last longer because it got rid of, you know, any kind of bacteria.
Was that those safe levels of radiation?
Yeah, at the time they were safer, and believe it or not, there's still some irradiation of food that goes on today, but it's never taken a wide footprint, if you will.
Isn't that done before it comes to market? The stuff is irradiated.
Absolutely. And it's there to kill bacteria. Essentially.
Right. Talk to me about the ultrasonic dishwasher. That seemed sort of way before its time.
Yeah, and again, you know, all of these things I think were either real and worked or were visionary. And there were some things that, you know, they showed in the house that were things that didn't really work but were a projection of what could happen in the future. With the ultrasonic dishwasher, it used less than a cup of water.
Wow!
And it essentially used sound waves to clean the dishes, and it also, that particular unit acted not only as a dishwasher but as a storage unit for your plastic dishes.
That sounds like something we could use today to conserve water.
And I mentioned that in the book. I think that that's a particular technology that they should revisit because of the water shortages that are going on all over the world. This would be, you know, something that might be a much better way of cleaning dishes and using less water if they updated it with new technology.
I got to talk about the bathroom, too, because the bathroom, that was the first time you saw all, like, sort of everything one piece. the shower, yeah. And that it's amazing looking.
Yeah, that was Crane Corporation, which was a one of the partners. You know, the House of the Future had like 30 different partner companies. You know, for door locks and carpets and all kinds of stuff, but with the bathroom, Crane molded the entire bathroom unit in two pieces, an upper section and a lower section. And what really grew out of that, and you see today, are the fiberglass shower tub enclosures
right.
that are in most
right.
most production homes.
Wow.
That grew out of that particular research project. And so, you know, again, there were certain things in the House of the Future that became standard. Safety glass was
yeah,
another thing
yeah.
that wasn't standard at the time, but became more of an industry standard because of the House of the Future.
Now, one of the things I noticed, there are these people who, I guess, allegedly dwell in the House of the Future. There was a picture, a photograph of Pat Otis, and she's called the Housewife of Tomorrow.
Yes.
Were these people in the exhibit while people toured through it?
No, it was really for opening day and for all the publicity photos.
Oh, got it. Okay.
It was sort of the family of the future, you know, the housewife of the future, family of the future. So you had the husband and wife and the two children, a boy and a girl. You know, and that was supposedly the family of the future who could live comfortably in this house, which was about 1,200 square feet total.
Now, talk to me about scent control, because
yeah.
wasn't there an overwhelming smell of plastic?
Well, I got to tell you, I imagine that, like, when they first opened the House of the Future, it was probably like opening something packaged in, you know, some sort of plastic device that's packaged. When you first open it, you get that whiff of plastic smell.
Well, especially molded plastic. That reminded me of, like, the model airplanes I used to build at that time.
Yeah.
When you opened it up and yeah. there was that smell, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so with the ventilation system, the air conditioning and heating system, there was an option that you could put rose smell or pine scent into the air.
And, I love that.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of interesting. And by the way, they actually do that in a lot of, you know, commercial facilities
right.
and hotels and things like that, very subtly. But there's
wow.
a whole science behind,
wow.
You know, putting smells into an environment and color. And it has an effect on people's psyche, you know, depending
yeah,
on what kind
yeah.
of color palettes
well,
are and things like that.
Well, also, you're getting an awful lot of people wear and tearing the place as they walk through it. I mean,
yeah.
the number of people that visited was amazing. We're going to run out of time, but I have to ask you, why was it eventually closed after only 10 years?
Well, you know something, it was still a very popular attraction in 1967,
yeah.
but what happened was Monsanto had taken out the Hall of Chemistry and replaced it with a new attraction called Adventure Through Inner Space, and that became a very popular attraction, and they said at the time, you know what? We're done with the House of the Future. You're welcome to keep running it, but we don't want to keep paying for it.
So it became no longer cost effective to keep it open.
And so Disney said, well, you know, if the corporate sponsor is going to pay for the upkeep of it, we're not going to keep it there. There's other things we can do with that site. And there was talk about putting in a restaurant there, which never materialized. But they did remove the house because Monsanto stopped being, quote, the sponsor and paying the annual upkeep of the house.
Now, what's great to read is that it wasn't easy tearing the house down. It was actually so well made that it was hard to tear down.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was surprising to me was that after a decade and 20 million people going through the house, that it had settled less than a quarter of an inch,
now,
which I thought was pretty phenomenal because most regular homes settle a little more than that.
Now, there are just a few scant remnants of the house still visible at Disneyland?
Well, there's really just a what's called a retaining wall.
But that's good. That's good enough. But I should say that you need to buy the book because you detail exactly what you can see of the mere remnants that are left of the House of Tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of people say it's the foundation, but it's not the foundation. It's a retaining wall that actually attached to the foundation, but it's not the foundation. The actual foundation of the house is gone along with the rest of the home, but they had budgeted one day to tear the house down. It wound up taking 5 days. The initial attempt with a wrecking ball. The wrecking ball actually bounced off of the house. So they wound up having to use chain clamps to crush it into pieces. And then those pieces were carted off to the Brea landfill not far from Disneyland. And that's its final resting place, buried in the landfill.
Now, I do want to mention briefly, again, we only got like 1 minute left. I don't know if this is still extant, the House of the Future, Retro Future Suite at the Howard Johnson Anaheim Hotel.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that still there?
Yeah, when I was writing the book, they reached out to me, and
man.
I had my wife and I stayed in the suite about a month and a half before it opened to the public. And I have to tell you, I had to put it in the back of the book.
Oh, it's great.
If you never saw the House of the Future, this is as close as you can get to being in it, you know?
Complete with shag artwork. We're going to leave it there. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is David A. Bossert, award-winning artist and filmmaker with over 35 years' experience in the animation industry. And we're talking about his book, The House of the Future, Walt Disney, MIT, and Monsanto's Vision of Tomorrow. It's a beautiful, fascinating book. David, it's a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.